Good morning. This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large for Sunday, April 22nd, 2012, originating from the Harold and Blanche Koch News Studio at KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotrimadholkar. On this edition of Ozarks, we learn more about a nonprofit organization in Siloam Springs serving special needs children and their families. An excerpt from President Bill Clinton's inaugural lecture in the Dale and Betty Bumpers Distinguished Lecture Series and an award-winning exhibition at the Rogers Historical Museum explores more than 150 years of history of law and order in the region.
The University of Arkansas Theater presents Cabaret now through Sunday, March 4th at the University Theater Fine Arts Center in Fayetteville. This classic musical examines what it means to be free and the intricacies of love and war. Tickets and more information available at 575-3946. A new report from the National Women's Law Center says there is still a significant wage gap between men and women in the United States. For every dollar earned by a man in the U.S., a woman earns 77 cents. In Arkansas, the gap is wider still. A woman earns 75 cents for every dollar earned by a man in this state. While there has been improvement in the past 50 years, in 1962, the national average was 59 cents to a dollar. Not much progress has been made in recent years. This morning, Emily Martin, General Counsel and Vice President for the National Women's Law Center, discussed the new report's findings.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons for the pay gap, but unfortunately, one of the reasons really does seem to be discrimination. So even when you do a more exact comparison, you look at people in the same occupation with the same levels of experience, working the same hours, looking at all the things that might affect the pay gap, and it does in some ways, you still find an unexplained gap of anywhere from, say, 7 to 15%, most studies say, which really does seem to be driven by the fact that a lot of people still think that women somehow deserve or need money less than men do and pay them accordingly.
Now, I know your title is not psychologist, but is this overt discrimination or is this something that's deeper rooted in our society?
Well, again, it's hard to say for sure, but I think there are elements of both. I mean, you can certainly find overt discrimination out there. But I think there are also assumptions that people don't necessarily examine when they're thinking about pay and when they're thinking about what is a reasonable rate to pay somebody. So I think both definitely play a part.
Arkansas has a wider wage gap than the rest of the country, 75 cents to a dollar. So is there a reason that poorer or more rural states have a larger wage gap?
It is true that in urban areas, sometimes the gap is smaller. So the rural nature of Arkansas may contribute to it. It may be the particular occupational breakdown in Arkansas. So, for example, I don't know about Arkansas, but in Wyoming, which is the state in the country with the largest pay gap, there's a lot of traditionally male industries like mining and oil and gas that pay pretty well, where a few women are employed, so that may contribute to the wage gap in some states. Another thing that we see in the 17 states with the biggest wage gap, including Arkansas, is minimum wage set at the federal minimum at $7.25 an hour, which also contributes to the wage gap because women are about two-thirds of those making minimum wage or less. So a higher minimum wage, as some states have, helps lift women's wages and helps close the wage gap a little too.
This is very important. So many families now, and I would so many more than 50 years ago, are headed by a woman or a single mother or some, you know, a situation like that.
Yeah, about two-thirds of families depend on a woman's income either in whole or in part. So when women are paid less, it's not just unfair to the woman. It's unfair to the entire family that depends on the woman's wages.
So what can be done? So if you and I had a conversation in 10 years, that gap has been reduced.
Well, I think that there are definitely public policy responses that could help. The Paycheck Fairness Act is a bill that Congress has come close to passing before but hasn't, that would make some important changes, including making it unlawful for employers to punish people for talking about how much they make, which is something a lot of employers do now, which makes it awfully hard to figure out whether you're being paid less than your coworkers. As I said, raising the minimum wage, perhaps surprisingly, also could have an effect on the wage gap. So those are some things that we should definitely be concentrating on as we go forward and really try to get closer to equality.
When you look demographically, is there a difference in the wage gap, say, for African American or Hispanic women?
Yes, African American and Hispanic women face a larger wage gap than white women. So in Arkansas, for instance, African American women working full-time year-round are paid only 63 cents to every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men, and Hispanic women only 52 cents. So really significant gaps.
It would seem to me, that if you are a state with a wider gap than the national average, this could hurt you in attracting businesses. Do you have any idea if that's the case?
That's an interesting question, and I don't off the top of my head, but I think that there are a lot of reasons why fair pay is good for business. Certainly when you pay your employees well, they tend to stick around longer. They tend to be more invested in the success of the company. And so definitely from a business perspective, there are reasons to take stock of your pay practices and your pay structures and to really examine what you're doing to make sure that discriminatory patterns haven't snuck in without you quite being aware.
Finally, I mean, I imagine it's hard to find anyone who will outright say, well, I am against equal pay for women. I think this wage gap should exist. Who would be, for lack of a better term, the enemy here?
Well, a lot of people say, well, there's a wage gap, but it's all because of women's choices. Women choose to spend less time at work, and women choose occupations that don't pay as much because that's what women want. And I think that really ignores the fact that, again, when you control for these factors, when you look at occupations, women and men in the same occupation, working the same hours, doing the same thing, there are still these persistent gaps. And so I think trying to explain away the gap by saying it's just because that's what women want is really missing a lot of the problems that we still face.
There are more women earning bachelor's degrees now than men. There are more women in the workforce than ever before. While there still may be a glass ceiling, there are more women, at least more than there used to be, getting to management positions. Will this help as well?
It does help. Certainly, higher levels of education are associated with higher levels of pay, but higher levels of education don't make the wage gap go away. So, for instance, a woman who graduates college will often just make as much as a man who has some college or an associate's degree. So the wage gap continues, even though the actual amount of money that the woman earns goes up as she gets more education on average.
Emily Martin is General Counsel and Vice President for the National Women's Law Center. Emily Martin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. A week ago today, former President Bill Clinton delivered the inaugural Dale and Betty Bumpus Lecture, sponsored by the Dale Bumpus College of Agricultural, Food and Life Sciences. He began the 90-minute session by reminiscing about his days in Arkansas politics and working with the namesakes of the new lecture series, Betty and Dale Bumpus.
I want to say a few personal words, too, before we get into the more serious part of my talk. Everything that was said about Betty Bumpers this morning is true, but one of the things that I think all of you should know is the profound influence she had over people who cared about the health and welfare of children all across America before it was the thing to do. And the profound influence she had on the people who cared about the cause of world peace and what would be necessary to avoid the most calamitous consequences of war when it was actually still politically dangerous to say what was factually obvious. Hillary always said that it's a good thing families worked out the way they do because women always had the responsibility gene. And Betty Bumpers has the responsibility gene on steroids. I'll never forget the day when the Secretary of Health and Human Services, when I was president, Donna Shalala, came to me and said, well, we finally did it. We have finally immunized more than 90% of all the children in the United States. And the first thing I thought was, that's because Betty Bumpers put it in our heads to do so and told us we had to do it years ago. And our general concern for child health is really important. The most important thing my foundation does in America today, and I'll say a little more about it, is the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, which is designed to stem and reverse the tide of childhood obesity in America, which, if not done, could give us the first generation of children to have shorter lifespans than their parents. That, too, is something that grew out of a sensitivity I developed in no small measure because at the beginning of my career, I got to know Betty. I first met Dale Bumpers nearly 40 years ago, and I'm going to tell you a few stories. There are some I wish I could tell that I can't. When he ran for the Senate, I knew he was a great orator, and I knew he'd been a great governor. Dale loved nothing better when I was president than to introduce me to people as the second best governor Arkansas ever had. But the thing that made him successful was that he's one of the keenest judges of human nature I ever met. Now, the first time I met him, he was running for the Senate as a wildly popular governor against Senator Fulbright. And the truth is, just about all of us knew Senator Fulbright could probably not win another term. He'd been in the Senate 30 years. But I had worked for him in college, and that job enabled me to graduate from college. If I hadn't had the job, I probably would have had to drop out. And I was running for Congress. So I gave a 2-minute speech or something at the end, and it was a great night in Russellville at the River Valley political rally. So after it was over, I went up to shake hands with then Governor Bumpers. And he knew I was 28 and just starting out, nervous as a cat. And he knew I had worked for Senator Fulbright. And he shook hands with me, a kid he'd never met before, and he said, "Look, I know that you may be mad at me, but I believe Senator Fulbright will not be reelected. I respect what he's done for Arkansas, but I think I'd be the best person to replace him. And sometimes politics is a tough business." He said, "You're younger than I am, and someday you may think you should run for the Senate against me. And if you think it's the right thing to do, do it, and remember that I told you." And I thought, I'm not sure this guy means it, but he sure is smart. That was in April, this month, all those long years ago. In December, after he had been elected to the Senate, but when he was still governor, I asked if I could come and see him. And he agreed to see me, but for reasons I don't remember, we went to the governor's mansion instead of the office. And I said to him, "I didn't vote for you, but I'm glad you won. Be good for America. But 2 years from now, we're going to have another presidential election, and somebody just like you is going to be elected. It might as well be you. And if you want to run, I'll tell you right now, I will not be on the ballot in 76. I won't run for anything. I will work for you." And he looked at me and said, "I can't do that. I just got elected to the Senate. I gave my word I'd serve my term, and I intend to keep it." He loved Arkansas. I can tell you with all my heart, I believe if he had run in 76 instead of Jimmy Carter, he would have been elected president. He chose to honor his commitment to you. And it was very... So I got to where I'd call him for advice. When you're a governor, you got to support the farmers. And one of the things you have to do as governor is every year go to Gillette in the middle of rice country to the Gillette Coon Supper. Now, Gillette has about 800 people. It's the smallest town in Arkansas that fields a full 11-man football team. And very often they win their district because they raise enough money to support the team with this Coon Supper that has 1,500 people every year, twice the population of the town. And if you want to be elected something in Arkansas, you've got to show up. So one night the weather was bad, and David Pryor didn't even want to go, and Dale did, so we got an airplane and we flew down there. And it was snowing, and it was kind of icy snow, messy, you know. And Gillette has just the one lane airport. So this guy comes and cleans it off. There's lights on the side. And, you know, every airstrip has a big white paint, and then the angle is written in numbers on the end. So the guy that cleaned the strip cleaned it and stopped right at the end of the white line, over the white line. The pilot, wanting to give us maximum amount of distance to stop the plane, thinking that, you know, there might be some ice on the runway, tried to land exactly on the white line. He landed about a foot short of it, hit 4 feet of ice, the nose crashed down on the runway, both the propellers were mangled, and we went into a spin out into a rice field. And Dale's kind of a white-knuckle flyer anyway. We're sitting here, he said, get out, get out, get out. So we finally got out, and I said, we'll never lose Gillette again. And then I looked at him, and I said, you realize how many politicians we almost made happy? About 2 years ago, after all these long years, Dale Bumpers found and sent to me a copy of the picture of the plane we crashed, sitting out in the rice field with the nose busted and the propellers mangled. It said, dear Bill, a happy reminder of the night we almost bought the farm. I thank you for your friendship and for your leadership, for everything you ever did for me, for Arkansas, and for America. When you left the Senate, it was a poorer place. If it hadn't been for you and David Pryor, my economic plan in 1993, which gave this country the longest economic expansion in history, and four of my eight budgets running surpluses, would not have passed. We proved that invest and pay for it economics is better than trickle-down economics. We did too good a job. The country is so prosperous that they forgot how it got there, and they went back to the old way with the same results. I hope one day we will be on a more disciplined path to investing in our common future and paying for whatever we decide to do and cutting whatever we decide we don't want to pay for. And when it happens, whether anybody knows it or not, you, Dale Bumpers, will deserve a lot of the credit, and I thank you for that.
President Bill Clinton delivered the first Dale and Betty Bumpers lecture Sunday night inside the Verizon Ballroom on the University of Arkansas campus.
A new organization providing assistance not just to children with special needs, but also to their parents and their siblings, opened in Siloam Springs late last year. The opening brought programs and support that residents there once had to drive to Rogers or Fayetteville to receive. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas recently visited Ability Tree, and she filed this report.
On a sunny spring afternoon on Main Street in Siloam Springs, a group of children participates in an arts and crafts activity. The kids are involved in an after-school program organized by and located at Ability Tree, a nonprofit working with special needs children and their families. Of the 10 or so children in the bright room, about half have a disability. The other half are their siblings. Two of the kids are the offspring of Ability Tree founder and CEO Joe Butler. His son Micah, now 11, was first diagnosed with developmental disabilities at 9 months old. At that time, he and his wife Jen also had a daughter, Hannah. Joe was working full-time and in school.
And so the brunt of the, caregiving was on Jen, and it was difficult. She had a toddler and a newborn who wasn't sleeping and who wasn't able to keep his food down. And so it just was, when we came to embrace Micah as just as a gift, as a child with a purpose, we realized that our life mission was to reach out to other families like our own.
Although there are over 54 million Americans dealing with a disability, many are ignored by their communities, their families finding it difficult to cope and to feel accepted. At 2.5, Micah had a severe seizure. Diagnosed with cerebral palsy, he didn't walk until he was 4. Jen remembers how difficult it was to raise her family without any support from people in her area.
I just kind of began to feel like I'm alone in this and I don't have anybody to talk to. Nobody understands. Nobody's willing to help me even get places. I remember when we had our third daughter, Clara, I couldn't carry a 4-year-old and a baby car seat to go somewhere to even get to the car. And we had stairs, so I couldn't put them in a stroller to get to the car and just all these obstacles. But nobody would help me. And nobody, even if I asked, they looked at me like, well, why don't you just do this? And just feeling like, you know, if I feel like this, there are other parents that have children with even more severe disabilities than I am dealing with. How are their needs being met? They're alone, too.
And so they decided to see how others were living. The Butlers packed up their family, traveling for 26 months as U.S. missionaries, raising funds, reaching out to those in the special needs community, and sharing their story with congregations. That's where they met a pastor with a 22-year-old daughter with spina bifida, and the idea for a disability outreach center was born. Somewhere along the way, they connected with Josh and Stacy Allen of Allen's Incorporated, perhaps better known as Allen's Canning.
They basically talked to us and said, hey, you know, if you're going to do this thing, you should probably move to Northwest Arkansas. And we prayed about it, and we you know, considered all the options, and we'd never thought about moving to Arkansas.
But seeing a need in the Siloam Springs community, they did move to Arkansas, opening the first Ability Tree Center in the fall of last year. The name focuses on how all individuals have abilities, regardless of their disability. And while Jen does like trees, a tree also has strong roots, branching out in all directions, and exhibits change throughout the various seasons. Again, the kids here this afternoon are part of an after-school program. Monday through Thursday, they are transported by the school district to the center. The week's activities are centered around a theme. This week's theme, the letter A.
What?
Are you making an apple?
Surprise!
Kalia, what does apple start with?
A.
A, good job. We understand Allen's, one of their 18-wheelers coming tomorrow, and one of their representatives starts with an A. So we want to reinforce that A theme, and they're going to talk about vegetables and let them see the truck and tour the truck. And today they're making a craft. They're making an apple. They did watched Alvin and the Chipmunks yesterday, and they did another.
Unlike other organizations, Ability Tree involves the siblings of the special needs kids. Nobody feels left out, and siblings are able to meet others like them. Also, parents can get a much-needed respite. On the fourth Friday night of each month, there is a respite night. Parents can drop off their kids and get some much-needed alone time. Brandy Bollinger and her husband have a 10-year-old son with autism. On the Friday night respites, they drop him off along with their 3 other kids.
My husband and I go out to dinner. That's our sushi night. You know, we may go shopping. You know, that gives us an opportunity to go and get a few things done that we're just not able to do when we have, you know, all of the kids. And it's just a time for us to just be parents, to kind of refresh, recharge, and then we come pick them up, and you know, they've had an absolute blast. They're worn out, they're tired, and it's time to go home.
Living in Gentry, the nearest support was in Fayetteville, too far for the family to travel. Brandy says that prior to Ability Tree, she felt alone and was clueless that anything like this existed. The program has supplemented what her son was getting in school, allowing him to develop important socialization skills. With over 20 kids participating in these Friday night respites, volunteers play an important role in the organization, Lindsay Taylor is one of many volunteers.
The biggest thing that I've seen is really just the rest that the parents get from it. I volunteer one day a week in the afternoon during the after-school program, and then also the Friday night respite nights that they do. And so in both circumstances, you just hear comments from parents about, I was able to go to the grocery and not have to take all my kids with me. I was able to go to this meeting after work that I don't normally get to go to because I have to go home and take care of my kids. And so it's giving them the ability to do what they need to do. And then we just come and we just have fun and we play with them. And, you know, I didn't have to have any special training. It's just you have fun. And so there's that side of it where it helps the parents, but then I think it also helps the volunteers, too. I mean, it changes our perspective of what a disability is and teaches us that just because someone has a disability doesn't mean that you have to treat them any differently.
She mentioned REST. REST is what Ability Tree and the Ability Center revolve around. It's also an acronym for Recreation, Education, Support, and Training, not just for families, but also for the community that they are in. Joe Butler explains.
And we also want to help train churches, businesses, other organizations how to include individuals and families with disabilities into their programs, help them to focus their products on families that are impacted by disability and things like that. So just bring about a community awareness that everybody has ability.
The Ability Center's location on Main Street in downtown Siloam Springs is not by chance. Part of the mission of Ability Tree is to bring these programs to Main Street USA towns across the country.
This is our model Ability Center here in Northwest Arkansas. And it's been a great marriage with the community of Siloam because we have John Brown University, we have U of A, which is close by. We've helped to renovate a existing vacant building and revitalize the community while reaching out to families. And so that concept sort of clicked, like, hey, this works. There's a lot of vacant buildings on main streets across the U.S. And so let's look for those buildings that are vacant and renovate those while reaching out to families.
Involving families and involving their entire family. All three of the Butler's children are present this afternoon. Hannah, 13, Micah, 11, and Clara, she's 8.
If we just had a normal brother and he wasn't diagnosed with, you know, what he has right now, then we wouldn't have Ability Tree and we wouldn't come here after school. We wouldn't have the art programs and we wouldn't have all the camp stuff and we wouldn't really have the business. And so if it wasn't for Micah, then it wouldn't be here. So I was kind of glad to have a brother like that.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Madhokar. The award-winning exhibition, Benton County Crime Stories, is an exhibit at the Rogers Historical Museum that explores more than 150 years of history of law and order in the region. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda visited the exhibition and has this report.
Northwest Arkansas has a rich history with famous outlaws like Jesse James and Bonnie and Clyde, but not all of the stories about the law in this region have to do with famous criminals. Benton County Crime Stories is an exhibition at the Rogers Historical Museum, which explores the history of law and order in Benton County from the 1830s to the 1990s. John Burroughs, the assistant director of the museum, helped design the exhibit, which is the recipient of the 2011 Arkansas Museums Association Exhibit of the Year Award for an exhibition produced in-house.
We wanted to try something with new technology, the digital technology, interactive elements, computer interactives. We wanted to be able to present a deeper level of information to our visitors, and that's what help define the longer time period on this because we were able to do it as opposed to how we generally do traditional text panels. It's very limited in what we can present in terms of text and pictures. And the especially like the touchscreen interactive, the wanted poster interactive, it's fun for kids, but it also presents a great depth of information, talks about actual crimes that happened in this area during the 1890s. the whole idea, I think, just it came about. I've always been interested in this subject. I've always been in public service, and that I've always been interested in law enforcement and what those folks do for the community, and I wanted to take a look at the history of it in this area.
A centerpiece of the exhibit is a pair of old jail cells, which have been in the museum's collection for some time, but has only recently been restored.
One of our museum commissioners stored it on behalf of the museum. For 30 years, we didn't have the facilities and or the equipment or the expertise to really restore them, bring them back on display for a few years, and he was generous enough to store them for us, and that's just part of their long journey. That was in 1979 that he took them on behalf of the museum and stored them. The city of Rogers actually purchased these jail cells in 1894, and they've been in two different city halls. They were in our very first city hall, which was on First Street, north of Walnut, and then when we built the new city hall in 1930, they cut them apart and took them to the new city hall and rewelded them, and there they sat for the next few decades. And when the police department renovated its facilities in 1979, they decided to do something different for the holding cells, and they decided to get rid of them. So it's, I've talked to several officers who actually helped with that, and the police and fire department, every Public Works, everybody was involved in taking them out in 79, and it was quite a production from the pictures I saw on it. It was, holes needed to be knocked in the walls, and they flatbed trailers and all sorts of heavy equipment. And one of the police officers actually smashed his thumb and had to be rushed to the hospital. And it's so it's had a long and colorful history, I think.
The jail cells remained in an overgrown field for about three decades, where vines and trees grew between the bars. Burroughs estimates it took more than 700 hours worth of work to restore the cells. The assistant director explains it was important to preserve the metal, and removing the rust required wire brushes and elbow grease. The cells also had to be made safe for visitors because not only can they touch the approximately 7-foot-tall cells, they can walk inside of them if they ask a staff member to unlock the door.
Yeah, I've had a couple of kids. I'll put them in, and they always like to hear the door shut. That kind of great little clank. We actually restored it maybe too well. It had this wonderful grinding kind of moaning when you shut the door, and we cleaned it too well. Some of the metal preservative got down in the hinges and took that squeak out of the door. So all we have left is the clank.
Once inside, it's a tight fit. There's hardly any room to turn around in the space between a pair of bunk beds hanging on the interior wall and the metal bars that comprise the exterior wall. On the back of the door, a sign tells visitors that while it was free to land in jail, it will cost them $5 to get out. It's just a joke, but Burroughs says some children have been concerned about their insufficient funds once they've been closed in their new prison. Speaking of funds, it only cost the museum about $5,600 to produce the exhibit, and that includes the cost of restoring the jail cells. Next to these cells, there is another interactive feature Burroughs refers to as the listening station. Here, guests can listen to more than a dozen news stories from the 1890s to 1930s, as read by local actress Kay Cotton.
Came fellow instigators of the gag. County tax collector Reed Adcock inquired just what his purpose was. Austin gave them the dope on what he was looking for.
Aren't you sitting in the car that answers that description, Sheriff?
Asked Adcock. Speechless and flabbergasted, it dawned on the sheriff that he had been given the license number and description of his own automobile. Predictions made yesterday indicate more will come of this pending the sheriff's complete recovery.
I like that because it spans a huge time period, and it also spans, you know, the tragic to the ridiculous, just like today. And I think when you look at this exhibit, you really see that people are not much different at any time period. They're doing the same things. They're getting into the same kinds of mischief, the same kinds of crime. So I think that I think that helps tie, you know, the present to the past a little bit, because people just aren't that different ever, I don't think. So just like this, you know, this is just ridiculous. And we wanted to have a few lighthearted things in it because it spans, you know, just brutal murders, just tragic cases of death. And then, you know, I like having a few things like that. That's those things still happen today. That's always been interesting to me.
The title of another section is 3710, which is the name of an emergency frequency. A panel hanging on the wall lists 10 code phrases and their meanings. 10-4, for example, is code for message received. Burroughs says 10 code has basically gone out of use, but museum officials gathered information from an officer at the Rogers Police Department about what the local 10 code used to be. Burroughs and other staff members then recorded conversations using 10 code over walkie-talkies, and museum guests can now listen to the recordings and interpret them using the code listed on the text panel.
Go ahead. Traffic stop at 1 hour 5 minutes, 1032, 1028. I'm 72 Chevrolet Road. I'm contact 1023.
This section also features a red bubblegum light, which was used on top of a police car in the 1960s that you can turn on, as well as the sound of a siren. Burroughs recorded a 1960s siren that the Rogers PD donated to the museum. In addition to the interactive stations, the exhibit also features traditional text panels and a collection of historical objects, which includes an old still, a bulletproof vest, and a collection of badges through the decades. With so many different aspects, Burroughs says the exhibit should appeal to a variety of museum guests.
You can tell that when you look at this exhibit, it's presented a little bit differently than our other exhibits that we've done in the past. The text panels, you know, went with a large kind of image format to really emphasize something interesting that we found, or an image that really illustrates that particular theme for the panel. All of the photographs that we would normally put on a panel, you know, there's probably about 10 times the number of photographs that we'd normally be able to include on a panel. And by doing that and using this larger format, we're also able to put more information in the narrative that we're talking about on the panels. So I think it can appeal to a lot of different types of learners, people who like to read. Well, we have that. If you just like to browse at pictures, we have that. If you like hands-on things, we have that.
Benton County Crime Stories is on view now through 2013 at the Rogers Historical Museum. The museum is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and admission is free. More information is available at rogersarkansas.com/museum.
It's Sunday, April 22nd, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Iti Agnihotri-Mudholker.
With us in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm just going to introduce this topic and let you talk about it.
Okay.
It is the beginning of Rocket Music Week.
Yes. Well, that means a week devoted to people who make music, as well as people who listen to music, people who write music. Music in Northwest Arkansas.
And it starts tonight with the NAMA ceremony, the mm-hmm. Northwest Arkansas Music Awards, which I understand you will once again be on the red carpet.
I will. Here's what happens. Now, Bob Cochran and we have been co-hosting the NAMAs together for
312 years.
Roughly. Maybe 10 or 11. I don't
That's
know.
That's about right.
Not since the beginning, but close. And we hand out awards early, and then about the time Bob and I are...
Yeah,
they bring in some younger people. But it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Starts at 7, and it's at George's this year?
Second year now. It's been at George's.
Oreo Blue, Afrique Aya, Nathan A. and Max RPM.
Shannon
should
Wurst.
Be a lot of fun.
We'll be there, yeah.
And then...
Oh, and you don't have to be a musician to come. I think some people still think that it's some sort of closed thing, but no.
It's a ticketed event?
It is. Well, you pay to get in, sure.
Okay.
And then the week starts with all sorts of other things...
Mm-hmm. Conferences and
ends
seminars.
With these seminars on Saturday,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Okay. You can find out more about that all week on Kevin Kinder's blog, nwatunedin.com. And there's a whole bunch of things to do this afternoon.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Actually, one of them starts at 11, so we need to get on the move. It's okay. Bicycle Fayetteville Days.
And they got, you know what I'm going to, you know what I want to see in Bicycle Day? Because we had a small report on this on the Friday show.
Juggling bicyclists with chainsaws.
No. You weren't here at the Friday show. But there is something called the slow race that they're going to have. You get on your bicycle, and it's a 30-yard race course. The last one to cross the line without falling over or having their feet touch the ground is the winner.
Oh, that's
pretty
tough.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. Yes. And super tough.
Yes. That starts at 1:30, about the time the beer garden opens. My suggestion is if you're going to try to be in the slow race, to do it before you go to the beer garden.
Good plan.
Balance is key here.
And Three Penny Acre plays sometime during the day. There's
Bent
a poker
green.
Run.
Yes.
Fayetteville Town Center.
Yes.
There's a book signing this afternoon at Eureka Time in Eureka Springs with Diana Henry and photo editor Cynthia Morin. The book's called Whispering Ancestors, The Wisdom of Corn. That's from noon to 5. It's Picture Day in the Park, part of the Omni Center's Earth Day celebration, 1 to 3 at Wilson Park in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. No Sex, Please, We're British ends today at Rogers Little Theater at 2 o'clock. You might briefly call it a comedy of postal errors.
Okay. Yeah.
Last show, $10 to $45. $45 obviously comes with dinner. Clayton Conversations today at the Clayton House Museum in Fort Smith with furniture maker Gene Rapley. That's at 2 o'clock. And the last two shows of Mary Poppins at the Walton Arts Center, 2 and 7 o'clock. Tickets start at $60. Oh, we're not done yet. Book of Days, the only matinee of this show at the Arts Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. That's at 3 o'clock. And tonight, stand-up comedy again at the UARC Bowl with Tim Kidd. That starts at 7:30, and tickets are $7.
All right,
Becca. Thank you. Becca Martin-Brown is the features editor for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
The summer opportunities for children in the area continue to grow each year. An addition to the roster for the summer of 2012 is Piano Fest 2012. The camp is designed for children with no previous musical or piano education or experience. The week-long sessions are to help young people discover a love for classical music. It's the brainchild of Amy Lee Frenzel, a graduate music student at the University of Arkansas. She told me recently that she came to her instrument of choice, the piano, relatively late.
I actually had kind of an interesting background with the piano. I didn't start really taking serious lessons until I was 15. But ever since then, I started with a friend of a friend kind of who was a college student, and she kind of taught me the basics. And then when I was 17, I started to really kind of get into classical music, and I started with a professional teacher in the area named Anna Farish, and she really helped me develop my technique. And just a year later, I was able to audition and get a scholarship to study in East Texas with Andrew Parr. So it was kind of very fast.
So do you think you have this predisposed talent that just was waiting to come out? I mean, 15 is, I would imagine, among your contemporaries, is somewhat late to start.
Yeah, it's extremely late. And it's kind of been an interesting journey. I mean, I come from a musical family, but no one in my family is a professional musician, but everyone kind of dabbles in their own thing. So I think that maybe I had a little bit of a predisposition. And I always kind of fooled around with the piano when I was a kid. You know, I would pick out things by ear and teach myself, like, well, mostly the right hand of things because I knew how to read treble clef but not bass. And then when I was 15, I decided, you know, I really wanted to learn how to play, and one thing sort of led to another, and here I am. So,
well, Piano Fest 2012 is designed with young people in mind.
Yes. I think it's very important that we continue to educate kids in this really important tradition of classical music, because if you look throughout history, I mean, this has been such an important part of education back since like the 1500s and before, even like to Aristotle and Plato, that music was a really important part of developing the mind. And I really want to involve the kids in the area in this great sort of atmosphere we have for classical music in Fayetteville. And I think this will be a great way to do it, to really get them interested.
What's going
to
happen?
Well, the program is designed for people who have never played the piano before. So I've kind of oriented it towards kids that are between 5 and 10. I'm not obviously going to discourage anyone younger or older who wants to participate, but that's kind of the age range that I think will be really effective. And the kids will have, you know, over the course of 2 weeks, 4 private lessons with me, in which we'll talk about the basics of music, you know, rhythm and music and really just sound. And then on the weekends, I have the idea that I want the kids to get the kids together in a group sort of environment where we talk about music in a completely different way. So not just talking about how to play the piano, but talking about, you know, classical music and the famous composers. Like, I think one day I'm going to take, you know, the comic side of music and introduce them to pieces that they'll really enjoy, like maybe Carnival of the Animals by Saint-Saëns or the Surprise Symphony by Haydn, where there's these really funny jokes that I think the kids will really like and that will really draw them into the music. And then another day I might talk about, you know, the different affects of music, like when composers want to compose something sad or when they want to compose something happy, and how that makes a difference in how the music sounds. And I hope that will really inspire them to create their own sounds and express themselves in their own way.
How many slots do you have?
Well, I'm planning on doing 12 sessions or 2 sessions with 12 slots each. The first one will be in May, after the university lets out, so from May 15th to 28th. And then the second one is from June 18th to June 30th. And I know the one in May sort of overlaps with the finals week in school, but I've designed it so that the school schedule and the program should not conflict at all.
Is it a day-long sort of thing? When are the sessions during those days?
Well, during the week for the sessions, it will be like individually scheduled with me and the parent as far as convenience goes. You know, they'll have like 2 lessons during the weekdays, and then the group sessions will meet on the weekends in the afternoon so that it should be free from any sort of school conflict.
You're just bubbling with enthusiasm. You're really looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'm really excited. You know, my future vision, like what I want to do with my career, is I eventually want to start my own school for the arts and to obviously start with the piano, but then to expand in other areas. And I think I'm really enthusiastic about teaching children about classical music because I feel like it's becoming sort of lost in this generation. If we don't actively, as musicians, try to keep it alive, then you know, then we are responsible as well for its downfall.
What do people do if they're interested in bringing their child to this?
Well, obviously, contact me. I believe there's going to be a link on the Community Music School website, which is cms.uark.edu, and there'll be a link where the parents can look at the information brochure that I've put together so they can see all the details of the program, and then there's also contact information for me. So they should get in contact with me so I want to talk to all the parents, of course, and the kids and really, you know, kind of gauge their interests and everything like that, and then I can get them an enrollment form, and we're on our way.
What else should we know? What have I not asked?
Well, after the program, I had the idea that the students would give a small recital of sorts, you know, nothing formal or, you know, stressful or meant to, but just something so that the students can share what they've learned in the program and how they've learned to make music at the piano just in the short 2 weeks. And I hope that will be really exciting for them.
Well, congratulations on launching this and best of luck.
Thank you.
Amy Lee Frenzel is the director of Piano Fest 2012, a camp designed for children from age 5 to 10 who have little or no previous musical education. The camps are scheduled for May and June.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 22nd of April, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist Henry Fielding, born in Sharpham, England, 1707. Grew up rich, carefree, studied literature at Eton, flirting with girls. But when he was 21, he found out that his father could not support him anymore, and suddenly he had to make a living, so he turned to writing. He started out writing satirical plays, 25 of them, in about 10 years, which were so critical of the government that the government passed the Theatrical Licensing Act of 1737, which demanded that every play be approved and licensed by the government before it was performed, whereupon Fielding stopped writing plays, became a barrister, but after Samuel Richardson's novel Pamela was a huge success, Fielding, who thought it was a terrible book, turned to writing novels, including Joseph Andrews and Tom Jones. And it's the birthday of Paula Fox, born in New York City, 1923. Her parents, charming people, had no interest in being parents. Her mother, a beautiful socialite. Her father, a Hollywood screenwriter. They loved drinking, going to parties. And a few days after the girl was born, they abandoned her at an orphanage in Manhattan. She was passed off to various caregivers, married and divorced a second time, wrote stories. And then in the 60s, she published 15 books in 10 years, including Desperate Characters, which was rediscovered a few years ago by the novelist Jonathan Franzen, who fell in love with it, wrote an essay in Harper's, whereupon W.W. Norton reprinted Desperate Characters. Paula Fox also wrote a memoir of her childhood, Borrowed Finery. Here's a poem for today by Ann Pearson Wise entitled Everything But God. In Europe, you can see cathedrals from far away. As you drive toward them across the country, they're visible, stony, and roosted on the land, even before the towns that surround them. In New York, you come upon them with no warning. Turn a corner, and there one is, on Fifth Avenue, St. Patrick's, spiny and white as a shell in a gift shop. Dark St. Agnes, lost near a canal and some housing projects in Brooklyn. Or St. John the Divine, listed in every guidebook, yet seeming always like a momentary vision on Amsterdam Avenue, with its ragged halo of trees, wide stone steps ascending directly out of traffic. Lately, I have found myself unable to pass by. The candles' anonymous wishes waver and flame near the entrance, bright, numerous, transitory, and eternal as a migration. The birds that fly away are never exactly the same as those that return. The gray flowering arches' ribs rise until they fade like bones, so large and old they belong to an undetected time on earth. Here and there, people's small backs in prayer, the windowed saints' robes, orchid glow, the shadows, ghosts of a long nocturnal snow from a sky below which we did not yet exist, with our questions tender as burns. A poem by Ann Pearson Wise, Everything But God, from her collection Floating City, published by Louisiana State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world. You can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUIF is supported by the Fayetteville Athletic Club, offering a network of positive attitudes and activities for individuals, friends, and families with the desire to be the best they could be. Information regarding weight loss, personal or group training, strength training, and more available at fayac.com or 587-0500.
This is KUIF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Bentonville, Bella Vista. A listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, pursuing peace through education at arkansas.edu/Fulbright.
If you want to see me in a tuxedo, you can go to the Northwest Arkansas Music Awards
that are
at George's Majestic Lounge tonight. I'll be co-hosting part of that event. I think doors open at 7. The festivities get going around 8 o'clock, honoring musicians of all kinds of music tonight.
It does sound exciting.
It's a lot of fun.
You'll have a lot of fun, yeah.
Yes. This year going basic black and white, too.
No colors.
No vibrant colored tuxedo.
I remember the last time you wore like a pink.
Pink vest, yeah. But no, this year.
That was pretty spectacular.
It was something. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar.
Have a great rest of your weekend. Or Sunday. Sure.